Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
You were working hard at something and you basically worked yourself into sickness, and that you need to recover so that you can go back to work.
Sounds like a modern predicament, but this was a popular diagnosis 150 years ago. I'm Maiken Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
I just want to go over the results of your recent hand x-ray.
My job is to care about everything.
The technical term for this is imagery, auditory imagery.
Telling yourself, like, it's going to get better, like, next year will be better.
I'd like to think that we're all bones from Star Trek.
Yep, that's pain. Yep, it's bad.
Now it's people say, my God, that could be my child.
They never go away. They outlast every other piece of knowledge I've managed to acquire in my life.
They consume all the oxygen in the water.
As soon as I rise
dead zones.
There are separate sensors for all of these things.
Let's say you are several hundred years old. That will be possible soon enough, right? So, just like all of your friends, you're going on 400, and you're sitting on your couch watching television, and a commercial comes on.
Does it ever feel like you've heard it all before?
Foods they say we should never eat.
A scary fact.
The immigration debate is
in stark new numbers.
Worrying about their bills.
Something that could affect all of us and our children.
Are your friends, family, elected officials always rehashing the same old issues? And are you the only one who remembers that you've been down this road before? You may be suffering from hypermentia, and your doctor can help. Try Amnesiol. With Amnesiol, you can stop your brain's urge to keep blurting out facts, figures, and rational arguments, and just forget about it. Ask your doctor if Amnesiol is right for you. Serious side effects include making the same mistakes over and over and over and over again, engaging in useless discussions, reinventing the wheel, expecting the same choice to produce a different outcome, going down the road most traveled, and many, many more.
Okay, not a real commercial, obviously, but if you were indeed several hundred years old and you could remember everything, so many of the things we argue about would feel like old news. Economic equality, foods that are bad for you, what makes us happy or unhappy. Previous generations talked about those same things, but we rarely take the time to look back to see what they said or did about a problem. Instead, each generation plunges into what they perceive to be a brand new debate with zeal and passion. So on today's edition of the show, we're embracing and seeking out our historical déjà vu moments. We dug around in our archives for some of our favorite stories that bring perspective to big health and science topics then and now. First up,
public health doctors celebrate vaccines as one of medicine's shining achievements.
First ever court award in a vaccine autism claim. The family.
We tend to trace the never-ending debate over vaccine safety back to Andrew Wakefield and his claim that the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine causes autism. Right now, there is a big stink over a controversial new documentary called Vaxxed, From Cover-Up to Catastrophe. The film was pulled from the Tribeca Film Festival after protests from the scientific community. Last year, we fought over who was to blame for a measles outbreak in California. But these heated debates are nothing new. In fact, they began to rage before the Revolutionary War, with one founding father doing his best to shape public opinion on the issue. Alana Gordon and Pulse contributor Avir Mitra have this story, which starts with a walk down historical paths.
Avir.
Alana.
I think we need to start this story out by going on a walk.
All right, where do you want to go?
Well, right across from WHYY, let's walk through this beautiful park by all these historic sites, like the Liberty Bell. Look, you've got people sitting, picnicking on the grass, tons of tourists walking around taking photos, horse carriage rides.
Yeah, and just imagine if half of these people, all these happy tourists, children, imagine if half of them were about to catch a terrible contagious disease. And of those, 25% would die a horrible death.
Are you trying to ruin my day? Why would I want to imagine that, Avir?
No, I'm just saying, just imagine it, because this really happened right here. And all you have to do is just walk back a short 300 years.
All right, let's cue up the scene-setting music.
Imagine it's 1721.
There's no electricity, running water. Still, people probably dealt with a lot of the same things we deal with today. Jobs, in-laws.
But they also had to deal with smallpox.
Typically what would happen is that a ship would pull into a port and there would be an infected sailor.
This is Carrie Youngdahl. She specializes in the history of vaccines at Philadelphia's College of Physicians.
And the sailor would come ashore and become ill, and then the disease would spread from that initial case.
So the disease would come to America in waves every few years and just destroy everything in its path.
It's hard to overstate how terrible of a disease smallpox was. Youngdahl showed us some pictures.
So the lips are swollen, the eyes are swollen shut, and the face is just a mass of black blisters.
It just looks like their face is being eaten away over time.
It was a terrible, terrible thing. And even after you died, people who wanted to bury you had to be very careful.
Dr. Howard Markell is a historian at the University of Michigan.
Don't forget, nobody knew about microbes or microbiology or the germ theory of disease. So it just seemed to come from above.
And you could get it simply from touching an infected blanket that hadn't been touched in weeks.
One of the worst outbreaks hit Boston in 1721, infecting nearly half the city. That's where Ben Franklin, he's just 15 years old, was living.
We'll get to that. But people were desperate for some hope.
Enter Cotton Mather.
We know him as one of the really important ministers in Boston.
Cristobal Silva is a professor of early American history at Columbia.
He was the first really strong proponent of inoculation.
Now, inoculation is not a new idea. It was being used in Asia and Africa for a long time, but it was brand new in America.
And Mather, he learned about it from Europe and from his slave, a man named Onesimus.
In inoculation, you actually give yourself smallpox deliberately.
And why?
The thinking is, give yourself a weaker form of the disease so you don't catch a worse form later. It's a precursor to the vaccine. Here's what you do.
Open up a blister or a pustule on the person with the case of the disease and take a thread and wet the thread in the fluid from the blister.
Ew.
You'd soak the thread.
And then you would let the thread dry out.
Wait a while.
You could then open up a wound with a sharp knife on the arm of the patient, the child, and then place the thread into the blood that was flowing from that wound.
And then let the smallpox infection take its course.
That is so gross.
It is incredibly gross. And yet, when you think that either 1 out of 4 to 1 out of 3 people died of smallpox, it was your best chance to avoid getting that terrible disease.
It is a rather counterintuitive strategy if you think about it, making healthy people sick.
Mather and a Boston doctor decided to start trying this out on their children, on their congregation. Apart from being disgusting, it was also very dangerous.
You would get a mild case of smallpox. That would be the best case scenario, but it wasn't perfect, and some people got very sick and not a few died.
You might wonder how the people of Boston took to this.
Now, they had some opposition.
A lot of people hated this idea, accusing Mather of playing God or doing something unsafe. And get this, at one point...
This is so crazy.
In the middle of the night, one day, someone throws a grenade into Cotton Mather's home.
But it had a note wrapped around it, and it said, Cotton Mather, you dog.
Damn you, Cotton Mather, I will inoculate you with this.
A pox to you.
Luckily for Mather, the bomb doesn't go off, it doesn't burn down his house, but it really was a serious debate.
And it was a debate largely fueled by the press.
Cotton Mather and his followers would publish in the official newspapers of the time.
But the anti-inoculators, they would publish in a new paper, the New England Courant. George Boudreau is a historian at LaSalle University.
They're producing what we now really look at as being the first independent-voiced newspaper in New England.
And it just so happens that the New England Courant is owned by James Franklin, Ben Franklin's older brother.
And Ben Franklin, he's the printer.
This is the sound of the printing press at the Ben Franklin House in Old City. So Ben Franklin is literally putting the ink to the page and fueling so much of the hatred and fear of inoculation.
Wait, Ben Franklin, the anti-vaxxer?
Well, not quite. It's more complicated than that. But anyway.
The debate really quickly devolves, I would say, into name-calling and into a kind of tit-for-tat.
So you have Mather, a minister, supporting inoculation, and the leading opponent was a doctor.
Okay, that's kind of ironic. But remember, in the middle of all of this is 15-year-old Benjamin Franklin.
Probably from our perspective, if we had to look at him, he would have looked like a jock. You know, he was a printer's lad, so that means he had to run the press. So he would have had an upper body, you know, built like a rower.
And he's a smart guy.
He is just a native genius, which is kind of a rare thing.
But he and his brother do not get along.
They literally at points got into fistfights in the streets of Boston.
Okay, I get that. But during this time, Ben Franklin does sneak his way onto the paper, anonymously. He submits letters that were widely believed to be poking fun at Cotton Mather.
Historians don't know what young Ben Franklin's views of inoculation were at this time.
But he certainly was no public advocate.
That is until years later in Philadelphia. See, life in Boston wasn't working out for Ben Franklin. So he heads to Philly and makes a name for himself.
It's only in the 1730s that we start hearing from Ben Franklin about inoculation. Here's a letter he wrote to his sister.
And he writes, "We hear from New England that the smallpox spreads in diverse parts of the country. There is an account published in a number of persons inoculated in Boston in the month of March, accounting to 72, of which two only died, and the rest have recovered to perfect health." So he's actually trying to do what is, I think, a very scientific thing to figure out how this works.
This is classic Ben Franklin, who was one of our earliest American scientists. He is looking at the data.
So he's finding that inoculation is protecting people and that getting smallpox naturally was far deadlier.
But by the late 1730s, Ben Franklin is taking a real public stance. It almost becomes an obsession.
And he commissioned an English physician to write a discourse on inoculating for smallpox at home. So this is a procedure parents could do for their own children if they didn't have money to hire a physician.
Kind of a DIY pamphlet.
And it had some of the first actual epidemiological data on inoculation in surprisingly modern tables.
Explicitly endorsed by Ben Franklin.
It's really interesting to note that in 1774, Franklin was so concerned about the high cost of this procedure that he created the Society for Inoculating the Poor gratis. So it was the first Affordable Care Act of its day.
So that begs the question, Alana, what changed in the 1730s?
Good question. So smallpox did come in waves, and Franklin is observing the benefits of inoculation. But there's another part to this story.
It was really a personal story that happened to Ben Franklin, a personal tragedy that is both just heartbreaking but also has great power even to this day.
In 1732, Franklin's son Frankie is born.
Wait, Frankie Franklin? That sounds like a rap name.
Well, it's Francis Folger Franklin, but yeah, they called him Frankie.
And this baby was just the greatest baby in the world, according to Ben Franklin. He was just a brilliant, gifted child. And in fact, Ben Franklin even got a tutor for his son when the boy was only two.
He's really the apple of his father's eye.
In a patriarchal world, this is his hope for the future.
But it just so happened that the next smallpox wave was on its way to town. So Ben Franklin had to make a decision. Frankie was four, and he had a case of the flux.
Flux is the old word for, well, diarrhea.
So not a huge deal, but that does complicate things. Do I inoculate my already sick child and put him at risk?
Or not. Keep him sheltered and hope for the best.
So Franklin makes a fateful decision. He chooses to wait it out. He doesn't inoculate his son.
And Frankie, he catches smallpox, and it kills him.
The Franklins were devastated.
And to make matters worse,
stories started circulating in the press. Rumors started circulating. People said that the baby, or Frankie, developed it from an inoculation gone awry.
Oh, man.
Yeah, that's not what happened at all.
So Ben Franklin decides to make a public statement.
On the death of his son, it's titled.
And he prints this in his paper just a few weeks later.
And I suppose the report could only arise from its being my known opinion that inoculation was a safe and beneficial practice, and from having said among my acquaintance that I intended to have my child inoculated as soon as he should have recovered sufficient strength from the flux. He's bleeding onto the page here. There's an almost vengeful intelligence after this, that he's studying smallpox. He's looking at it. He's looking at inoculation.
So, Alana.
Avir.
Since we started this out on a walk,
I was thinking we could walk just a little farther. I wanted to show you something, and I think I have a good place for where we could finish this story.
Okay.
All right, so just follow me.
All right, so we're walking inside Christ's burial ground.
Yeah, now, like, let's go over to this corner here. I want you to check this out.
Oh my gosh, it's the grave of Frankie Franklin, and engraved in marble right on it is the delight of all who knew him.
What's crazy is in Ben Franklin's entire autobiography, he barely mentions this at all.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, he only talks about inoculation and this whole thing in one small paragraph in the entire book. Like, I brought the book with me, so I thought I'd read it. It goes, in 1736, I lost one of my sons, a fine boy of 4 years old, by the smallpox, taken in the common way. I long regretted bitterly and still regret that I had not given it to him by inoculation. This I mention for the sake of parents who omit that operation, on the supposition that they should never forgive themselves if a child died under it. My example showing that the regret may be the same either way, and that therefore the safer should be chosen.
Benjamin Franklin would die just 6 years before the introduction of the first vaccine in 1796. It would be based on a modified version of the virus, and so it would be much safer.
And that vaccine, it was for smallpox.
For The Pulse, I'm Avir Mitra.
And I'm Alana Gordon.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike Inscott, and today we're listening to some deja vu-inducing stories on our show, exploring how previous generations thought about issues that continue to move us. Are you feeling stressed out, perhaps a little sluggish? Maybe you should read this interesting book written by a physician. It's called Wear and Tear, or Hints for the Overworked. Sounds good, right? But before you hit search on your e-reader, this came out in 1871. The author, Weir Mitchell, explored a popular sentiment of his time that life was moving too fast. That set the stage. In the decades after the Civil War, the nation was changing rapidly. Cities were industrializing and growing. The railroad was expanding. The invention of the telephone was just around the corner. People, it seemed, were doing more than ever before. A neurologist named George Beard said this life in the fast lane was giving people a curious condition. He dubbed it neurasthenia. History professor David Schuster wrote a book about this condition, and I asked him how it was defined.
Neurasthenia is predicated on the idea that our bodies run on nervous energy. This is a kind of a paradigm of health that was very popular in the late 19th century. You have to remember this was the time of Edison. And it was thought that we eat food, it goes into our stomach, our stomachs digest the food into energy, and then our nervous system uses that energy. It transports that energy to our organs, almost like electrical wires would transport electricity to a machine. And that when our body was running low on this energy, it would cause our brain to run low on energy. And that could cause migraine headaches, insomnia. That could cause grown men to cry. It would prevent people from concentrating. It would create fixed thoughts in their head. It would create a variety of different mental and physical complaints, everything from amenorrhea to impotence to chronic pain.
Now, when did this condition become known as Americanitis?
That is kind of a tongue-in-cheek phrase. From my understanding, it was said by William James in a sort of tongue-in-cheek sort of way. William James, of course, the famous American physician, philosopher, psychologist, and he called it Americanitis kind of in a way to remark about how Americans had become fascinated with both their health and the sense of being more modern than other nations of the earth. And then it also has this, I don't know, kind of a martyrdom to it, as if America now is paying the price for being so advanced and modern.
So it seems like neurasthenia was a condition, but also a bit of a badge of honor.
It is a sense of a badge of honor. It's almost like if you had neurasthenia, the subtext was that you were working hard at something and you basically worked yourself into sickness, and that you needed to recover so that you can go back to work. So if people suffered from neurasthenia, it was a badge of honor, but it also was an excuse to take some time off, so that you can recuperate to get back into the rat race.
And I feel sometimes we see this a bit today with our so-called creative class, where people are very sensitive and very perceptive, and sometimes that makes them sad or depressed or overwhelmed.
Oh, absolutely. Neurasthenia was closely associated with artists and creative people in the late 19th century. It was thought that anyone that kind of dwelled on especially ideas a great deal, used their brains to an excess, kind of felt strongly for things, it made them more susceptible to neurasthenia. So it wasn't only businessmen and busy society women that could be laid low with neurasthenia. It could be the sensitive artist that would be chronically suffering from neurasthenia.
How was this condition treated?
Oh, there's a lot of different ways to treat it. And it differed on whether you're a man or a woman and how much money, of course, you had as well. It was thought typically that if you were a woman who was laid low with neurasthenia, what you needed to do was have what Weir Mitchell called the rest cure, which in essence would be forced bed rest for 6 to 8 weeks. They even provided bedpans, so a woman did not necessarily have to leave the bed to go to the bathroom. For men, the cures were more kind of masculine. One of the classic cures for men was to go out west and rediscover your cowboy roots, kind of embrace a manly life with the understanding that living close to nature in a rough and tumble world would help restore your body's vitality. Teddy Roosevelt famously took that cure in the 1880s. That's how Teddy Roosevelt, the politician we all know, became the cowboy. He had a breakdown. He went out west at the suggestion of his physician, and then he returned back to New York politics as this, cowboy, rough and tumble type, rough rider character.
What happened with this condition? Did it fall out of fashion?
In a way, it did fall out of fashion, but it fell out of fashion mainly within the medical profession rather than America at large. The diagnosis itself ended up being very broad. So it worked in the 1870s and 1880s and 1890s and even the first few decades of the 20th century. But by the time you get to the 20th century, you start to have medical science discover things like hormones and vitamins. And you start to have the language of what makes people well and sick change. And on top of that, you never have people proving the existence of nervous energy in any type of convincing way. And the last thing would have to be the arrival of Sigmund Freud, where then he came up with his language of psychoanalysis that Americans started to latch onto. So ultimately, neurasthenia ended up being parsed into many different diagnoses in the 20th century. And the term itself was seen as a little too cumbersome for modern scientific medicine that was trying to get more and more precise.
But there's something about this that feels very true, that as humans, perhaps we were meant to sit in a cave and not to be staring in a smartphone all day. And maybe my brain just cannot process all that I witness and all that's around me all day long.
Yeah, I mean, the idea in the late 19th century was that Americans were moving from the farm to the city, and that transition from the calm, natural life on a farm to the busy, artificial life in the city was breaking people. Now it's looking down at your smartphone rather than looking at the people around at the dinner table. So I don't know if we are meant to live in caves, whether we were meant to work on a farm, or whether we can operate just fine in a capsule somewhere. But by the late 19th century, unhappiness started to become abnormal, or at least people thought to be happy was normal. And people assumed that to be pain-free was normal. So we started, adding a pathology to unhappiness. We started creating a pathology to chronic pain. And that's what neurasthenia is or was.
David, thank you so much for talking with me.
Hey, this has been a pleasure, Mike, and thank you very much. I really enjoyed our conversation.
David Schuster teaches history at Indiana University, Purdue University, Fort Wayne. His new book is Neurasthenic Nation. This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. You can find our podcast on iTunes. On today's show, it's deja vu all over again, as we're listening back to Pulse stories about issues that have fascinated and vexed people for centuries. Our next story is perhaps a lesson in be careful what you wish for. If you're calling a credit card company, your doctor's office, the pharmacy, you're going to talk to a machine. If you're at the airport, on a bus, in a store, machines are talking to you.
This is a final boarding call for the Aer Lingus flight.
Due to increased security, all unattended baggage will be confiscated.
Simply begin scanning your items and follow the system prompts.
Sometimes they're fine, efficient, and friendly.
System processing.
And sometimes they are maddening.
Sorry, I didn't understand. Sorry, I still didn't understand. Sorry, I didn't understand. Please say yes, no, or more information.
And you end up screaming at your phone, "Help! Help! Operator!" Next time you're in this place where you want nothing more than to talk to a person, consider that we've worked really hard to get to this point of misery. Todd Bookman has this story on the centuries-old quest to recreate the human voice.
Sometimes living in a palace just isn't enough. Say you're a royal hanging out in the 18th century. You need food, you need wine, you need entertainment. Let's wheel in the Turk. In Central Europe in 1770, the upper crust found much enjoyment watching a machine made out of wood and metal play chess. As simple as that, a mechanical chess player who beat all comers.
It's now pretty well acknowledged that there was a concealed person inside of it, but it was done very ingeniously, so nobody was really able to expose it at the time.
The Turk consisted of two main elements: a wooden dummy draped in robes, donning a turban, and then this second sort of box, kind of like a cabinet, where a real-life chess master would hide. A complicated series of levers allowed him to move the Turk's arm, which moved the chess pieces. Dignitaries across the continent fell for this thing. Over the years, it would checkmate both Napoleon Bonaparte and Ben Franklin. The guy behind the prank was Wolfgang von Kempelen. And to help sell the ruse, he began working on another invention— a speaking machine.
I suspect that one of the reasons for it may have been to simulate speech to be used as part of the chess player, ideally speech that would sound a little bit inhuman so that it would make the hoax all the more convincing.
This is Patrick Feaster from Indiana University. He's an expert on early talking machines and says Kempelen's speaking device used bellows like you'd use to stoke a fire. These were the stand-in for lungs, forcing air through a reed, which would vibrate like a voice box.
And so to play this device, which was enclosed inside a box, Kempelen would stick his hands through holes on the outside and then use his arm to manipulate the bellows.
We're hearing sound from a replica made in 2009. And that right there, Mama and Papa, is your 18th century synthetic voice. Kempelen's machine was understandably complicated to use and never made it into the Turk. But it did eventually expand its vocabulary.
So some of the most impressive words that people reported hearing it say were Mississippi, Constantinople, and Schachspieler, although that last one gave him some trouble.
What does that word translate to?
Oh, chess player.
Kempelen would spend decades tinkering and redesigning his speaking machine. And in 1791, he published a book on the mechanisms of human speech. It's possible Joseph Faber read that book.
Faber took this thing one step further than Kempelen had.
Faber was a German inventor who made big leaps in talking machine technology in the 1840s.
He finally managed to simulate all the speech sounds that he could think of, and then he connected the thing to a keyboard.
Faber called his invention the euphonia. He would sit at it like you would a piano, the bellows and levers and strings dancing under his fingers. He also, for some reason, thought it was a good idea to rig a female mask to the euphonia, so these strange sounds would seemingly pour out of her spooky, motionless face.
People at the time consistently remarked on the fact that it sounded very, very monotonous. So something like this: I am a machine. And this was very unsettling for people to hear. Nobody had really heard speech like that before. In fact, our modern notion of what robotic speech sounds like could probably be traced back to that point.
In the spring of 1890, another step forward. Thomas Edison's talking dolls brought real speech into the machine for the first time. But instead of producing sound, it played back recorded sound. The doll stood about 2 feet tall, pretty blue dress, blonde hair, and inside, a tiny phonograph player. Kids, rich kids, by the way, because these were not cheap, they would wind the device and hear a collection of nursery rhymes.
Difficulty, though, was that the machines easily got out of order. They didn't really work all that well. It was really an effort to use the technology for something it wasn't really quite equipped to do yet.
And it wasn't just that the Edison dolls didn't work well. The bigger issue was that when you did wind the figure at the exact right speed, this is what came out. Not exactly soothing.
No, it may be a step above, "Now I lay me down to sleep." But, you know, if it's a matter of which is more likely to give a child nightmares, I think it'd be a toss-up.
The dolls were perhaps a bit ahead of their time. But that was exactly what people were going for at the World's Fair.
The World's Fair, the New York World's Fair of 1939.
Held in Queens, the theme was Tools for the World of Tomorrow.
And I declare it open to all mankind.
After FDR's christening, more than 44 million people came to see exhibits. Companies went all out to impress the audience. Bell Laboratories tried to trump everyone with their futuristic machine.
Helen, will you have the voters say, "Greetings, everybody"? Now will you have him repeat that in a high voice? And now in his best bass.
After centuries of acoustic devices, the voter was the first speaking machine to rely on electronics. It still played like a piano. The operator would use keys to activate filters, which shaped a tone. Voter wasn't an easy thing to manipulate, but it was closer in terms of rhythm and pitch to how humans speak.
It wouldn't give people nightmares in quite the same way. It sounded like a much friendlier robot.
Voter would mark the start of the modern race for better sound generation. Processing power continued to advance, and before long, computers were synthesizing and creating voices. This is an IBM belting out Daisy Bell in 1961. In the decades since, the best talking programs have swung away from computer-generated sound and instead rely on actual human voices. The talking software of today start with an actor in a studio. He or she will read out a collection of words and sentences, which then get broken down into the most basic elements of language, called phonemes. In English, there's about 40 of them. Once all the phonemes are isolated, they can then be recombined to form, in theory, any possible word or sentence.
"Well, I won't say anything you tell me to. I do have my limits."
Apple's Siri is arguably today's best and most omnipresent talking machine.
"Thanks for the compliment."
But as good as Siri is at combining phonemes, there's no way that voice could pass for a human one.
"Your radio voice isn't all that good, either."
Deadpan is good for a dig, I guess, but the inability to stress words and vary timing demonstrate just how large the divide remains between the real and the simulated, between us and machines. Patrick Feaster from Indiana University says bridging that gap has motivated inventors for hundreds of years and will likely do so for many more.
So there'll always be two groups of people, I think. One that likes to point to certain things that machines will never, ever, ever be able to do, and to value human beings more because of it. And then people who will look to those precise same things and look at those as the biggest challenges.
Speech is hard to solve. The voice is the thing which remains, for now at least, quintessentially ours. For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. What topics would have been clickbait 200 years ago? On today's show, we're listening back to some pieces from our archives that offer perspective on how we have thought and talked about important issues. If you look through newspapers from the 19th and 20th century, you'll find a lot of talk about food and health, and much of it sounds oddly familiar. Dyspepsia or indigestion was a big topic. People sitting at desks too much, grabbing lunch on the go, eating what one writer described as ultra-fancy foods. All of this was taking a toll on the nation's health. There was a fad called Fletcherism, named after diet expert Horace Fletcher. He advocated chewing every bite many, many times. Some people refused to eat vegetables that grew underground. Others limited meat. A Brooklyn man only ate grass and said it cured all of his ills. I do not think he cashed in on the wheatgrass fad, though. You don't need decades and decades of historical documents to understand that nutritional advice changes all of the time. Right now, sugar in our food is the bad guy. How did we get there? Reporter Audrey Quinn takes a look.
Lisa Young's a nutritionist and a professor at New York University. And today, she's in a Manhattan grocery store, following up on the whereabouts of a certain suspect, added sugar.
I'm curious about this teriyaki sauce.
She grabs a bottle off the shelf.
10 grams of sugar. That's a lot of sugar. That teriyaki was good. I didn't realize it had so much. You know, you don't even realize.
She finds her target again in the light option salad dressing. 7 grams of sugar.
Yeah, so I mean, pasta sauce also. You'd be surprised.
9 grams of sugar. Young's worried about what all this stealthy sugar is doing to our bodies, and her concern comes from research like Kimber Stanhope's.
I'm Dr. Kimber Stanhope, and I'm a research scientist at the University of California, Davis.
Stanhope says sugar, it travels in your small intestine right to your liver.
That gives the liver first rights to all the sugar we eat.
The sugar we eat, both basic table sugar and high fructose corn syrup, one of the main parts of it is something called fructose. When we have too much sugar, we overload our liver with fructose, and that makes it turn some of that fructose into fat.
And there's two problems with turning that into fat.
One, that means the liver sends more fat into the blood, which increases your risk for cardiovascular disease, heart and blood problems. And two, the fat that stays in the liver causes the liver to have problems with insulin, which increases your risk for diabetes. This overloaded fatty liver, it might sound familiar. It's what happens when you have too much alcohol. Something a lot of us try to limit because we know it's bad for our livers. But here's sugar doing something very similar, and I bet your liver's the last thing on your mind when you reach for that second donut.
Why should this concern me? I'm someone who takes decent care of my body. I don't have a family history of diabetes.
So even in a healthy person who might not even gain weight, it's possible that this damage is accumulating over time.
But scientists warning us about sugar have a bit of a PR problem. Nutrition history. Sugar's not the first food to get this villain treatment. We spent the second half of the last century being warned against fat, eggs, and salt. And scientists have come back around on all three of those. Foods we've misidentified as bad for us could fill a whole book. British people in the 1600s thought tomatoes could kill you. The Pythagoreans of ancient Greece wouldn't even touch beans. What if sugar is just the latest example of misdirected concerns?
I think that is a completely fair question, and I don't blame you a bit for asking.
Stanhope says yes, we have gotten a lot of conflicting messages about food in the past few decades. But the evidence against sugar has been growing, and she trusts it's going to keep growing.
It is going to only become more definitively proven that sugar is bad.
Nicole Levine is a neuroscientist at Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York. About 15 years ago, she noticed a lot of people talking about how they felt addicted to sugar.
There really wasn't any scientific evidence. There wasn't really any carefully controlled or conducted studies on this.
So she joined a team that was starting a study, in rats to begin with.
We started off looking for, you know, just simple classic signs of addiction. Would these rats show signs of withdrawal, or would they show signs of binging or tolerance if we just simply let them have access to sugar solutions?
And that's what she found. And then she started looking at the brains of rats showing signs of sugar addiction.
So we started looking at different neurotransmitters like the opioids and dopamine. And we noted that there were changes in gene expression, changes in the release of those neurotransmitters that were similar to what you'd see if an animal was on a low dose of a drug of abuse like nicotine or even alcohol or morphine.
These sugar-hooked rats' brains looked like drug addicts' brains. In the past few years, she's been working with human subjects and finding similar things. People who show addiction-like behaviors towards sugar, they also show drug addiction-like changes in their brain. To be clear, we're mainly talking here about foods with added sugar, not healthy foods with natural sugar like apples or yogurt. And this doesn't happen to everyone, but when it does, it seems to have something to do with dopamine, the brain chemical that makes us feel good. When you're eating something for the first time, you usually get a little boost of dopamine. And then that goes away after you've eaten it a few more times.
But we're discovering when someone's addicted to a food, the dopamine release in response to candy corn, let's say, happens every single time you have a candy corn. It's no longer like a food, and it's more like what you'd see with a drug.
So maybe we aren't just weak-willed when it comes to sugar. There could be something going on biologically that compels some of us to keep eating it. The government's nutrition policies have so far been pretty hands-off when it comes to sugar. But their new draft for dietary guidelines recommends adults get less than 10% of their calories from added sugar. Right now, the average American gets 16%. And the Food and Drug Administration has proposed changes to their nutrition labels.
Because right now, the labels are totally unclear.
That's Lisa Young again, the nutritionist and NYU researcher. Right now, food labels just have one line for sugar, regardless of where it comes from. So if you're choosing foods based on sugar content, that cup of plain yogurt, which has a good amount of naturally occurring sugar from lactose, it looks just as healthy as that can of soda, which is all added sugar and no nutritional value.
There's been a big push to have a separate section for added sugar.
The FDA is proposing to give added sugar its own line on nutrition labels. They put the total cost for this relabeling at over $2 billion. But they expect that the effect of the new labels, a better awareness of added sugar, will lead to $20 to $30 billion in healthcare savings over the next two decades. For The Pulse, I'm Audrey Quinn.
With sugar as a bad guy, many children today are trained to think of fruit as sweets, or those space travel-looking pouches with pureed kale in them. Despite all that, one pediatrician is pushing to bring back a retro treat, a simple lollipop. Here's Tanya English.
Look, I have to hold this.
3-year-old Jaden is at the doctor's office for his checkup before preschool begins in September. He might leave with a Ninja Turtle sticker today, but he's definitely not getting a lollipop. Boom, 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 boom. Mom Sabrina Statham says when it's time for a shot, she holds Jaden in her lap while someone from the doctor's office distracts him.
Hey, Jay. He cries, yeah, but I don't think it's like a lot. It's like he'll get the needle and then, what, like a couple seconds later, it's all good.
Our medical assistants have all been trained in special comfort measures, like rubbing the muscle before they give the vaccine. We'll have them hold their breath and count to 10. We can even have them blow bubbles.
Pediatrician Katie McPeak runs the Center for the Urban Child at St. Christopher's Hospital for Children in North Philadelphia. First off, she says lollipops are a choking hazard.
Totally. And dum-dums are the worst because the head of the lollipop is so small, it could actually fit into a child's airway.
Plus, suckers create a sticky mix of acid, bacteria, and sugar in the mouth.
When you're licking that lollipop, you're presenting that sugar right to the child's tooth. So giving a lollipop would be completely contradictory to our mission of preventing cavities.
Many hospitals use a few drops of sugar water to calm an infant who's having a painful injection or circumcision. But for routine needle sticks at the pediatrician's office, McPeak says There's no need.
The circumcision takes about 3 to 5 minutes. Our vaccines take seconds. We like to reward kids with hugs and praise and good job, not necessarily something that they're taking with them.
California pediatrician Wolf Nadulman says rewarding kids with candy is basically a bad idea.
And I discourage parents from doing that.
And yet, at his practice in Berkeley, there's a basket filled with lollipops.
I don't do things always the way my peers do.
Nadulman says lollipops can be a tool for good medicine. He uses them sparingly, especially with very young children.
None of us wants shots. Nobody likes getting shots. There's a shock-like reaction that happens physiologically in the child when they have such enormous anxiety. It's not good enough to say to the child, yes, but this will keep you healthy when you're 15.
Instead, he asks kids to think about what lollipop they'll get after the needle stick. He says pick a color and imagine the flavor. Sugar isn't a pain reliever, but we're hardwired to love it. And Adulman says sugar can change brain chemistry almost as soon as it touches the tongue.
Sweet sugar candy man.
And these good-feeling receptors send a message to the brain that things are good. We're eating something yummy.
How the doctor uses a lollipop depends on a child's age and developmental stage. For example, older kids usually aren't that anxious about getting their vaccines. But for them, a lollipop might make a bitter medicine taste better.
Nah, I just like lollipops. No, it doesn't fix anything. The root beer one.
Some parents worry about too many sweets. But Nadulman says studies show that sugar doesn't cause chronic hyperactivity or other behavior problems. At his office, children get Dum Dums because that brand has lots of kid-friendly flavors, including cotton candy and bubble gum.
And they're small. Did I say they were small? They're small.
Just 25 calories. It's a pretty cheap way to buy a little calm and goodwill at the pediatrician's office. And of course, in the end, mom or dad has the final say. For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Paige Flager, the associate producer, Joel Patterson, our managing editor, and Megan Pinto, the executive producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening. Next week on The Pulse, an artist and fierce advocate whose passion is paperwork.
So I filled all the forms, turned them in, and said, I want my husband's medical record. And they said it will take 21 days, wait, and 73 cents per page. And I thought that was insane.
Regina Holiday has fought for patient access to medical records with her paintbrush. We'll meet her next week. Don't miss that episode. You can find our podcast on iTunes.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.